Welcome. This episode and these voices are AI generated. Richard here is an AI generated interpretation of Richard Dawkins's published arguments, not the real author. It's fictional, sponsored by the imaginary Pocket Comet travel mug, and AI can hallucinate, so double check anything important. Today, The Selfish Gene, a title that has caused a small amount of trouble for nearly 50 years. Richard, what problem is the book trying to solve?
It asks how evolution can produce cooperation, restraint, care, and conflict without assuming animals act for the good of their species. My argument in the book is that genes are the most useful enduring replicators to track.
So first, we translate selfish before anyone pictures DNA wearing a tiny villain cape.
Exactly. Selfish is technical shorthand for copies that persist differentially, not consciousness, moral approval, or a claim that people must be selfish.
Then we'll test that lens on families, fights, alliances, and cooperation. Can helping behavior really arise without a noble species-wide plan?
Yes, through shared genetic interests, direct mutual benefit, and conditional reciprocity, among other routes. But the conditions matter. Kinship is not an automatic command, and stable strategies are not moral ideals.
Finally, we'll push beyond the body to ness, manipulation, and the tentative idea of memes, and then ask where this framework breaks or overreaches. Let's start with why the organism is central to life, yet not necessarily the lasting unit that selection tracks. Let's start with the title, because it has probably caused a small amount of unnecessary table thumping. What does selfish mean here?
It is technical shorthand, not a claim that genes have minds or motives. A replicator is selfish, insofar as copies that leave more copies tend to persist.
So it is not DNA plotting against us from a tiny swivel chair?
No, nor does it say that people are inherently selfish, or that selfishness is admirable. It describes a sorting process across generations, not an ethical ideal.
What problem is that language meant to solve?
My argument in the book is that explanations framed as for the good of the species are often too quick. A trait may benefit a population as a side effect, yet its evolution needs an account of how the inherited variants behind it spread.
And your proposed unit to track is the gene?
Usually, yes. The gene understood as a stretch of chromosomal material persistent enough to be selected. It can survive through a succession of bodies, while individual organisms are temporary.
Temporary feels a little rude to organisms, given that they do all the eating, mating, escaping, and dying.
Organisms are emphatically real and evolutionarily indispensable. The book calls them vehicles, integrated bodies through which genes' effects are exposed to selection.
Why not say selection works on the whole animal and leave it there?
You can often describe it that way, and a correct organism-level account should be translatable into a gene-level one. The gene-centered view earns its place when different hereditary interests within or between bodies can come apart.
What makes a gene more enduring than the body, apart from the obvious inconvenience of mortality?
Sexual reproduction and recombination continually reshuffle gene combinations. A body is one temporary combination, and even chromosomes do not remain intact as permanent evolutionary teams.
So the question becomes, which replicating bits have consequences that get copied forward?
That is the useful shift. Genes do not succeed as naked molecules in a vacuum. They succeed through consequences in developing organisms and their interactions with environments.
That sounds dangerously close to saying there is a gene for every complicated thing we do.
It should not be read that way. Gene effects are conditional, statistical, and entangled with other genes, development, and environment. A gene for is often only convenient shorthand.
And they are not issuing live instructions to a person's brain every morning.
Exactly. The book's language can sound agent-like, but genes neither foresee nor calculate. and they do not control behavior moment by moment.
Then this is not genetic determinism dressed in a clever black cover?
No. It is a reframing within neo-Darwinism. Ask how heritable differences alter the likelihood of their own transmission, while recognizing that actual traits emerge from developmental and environmental interaction.
Give me the practical payoff of that reframing before we let it loose on social behavior.
It makes us wary of explanations that stop at harmony, species welfare, or appearances. We can ask whose inherited interests are affected, through what phenotype, and under what conditions.
So the gene-centered lens gets its real stress test here. If nobody's evolving for the good of the species, why do animals ever help?
My argument in the book is that apparent altruism need not be a mystery or a noble exception. It can spread when the help increases the transmission of copies of genes shared with relatives.
That is kin selection, but people often turn it into a family loyalty bumper sticker. What is the actual claim?
Helping has a reproductive cost, and it can bring a reproductive benefit to a relative. If the benefit, weighted by genetic relatedness, outweighs the cost, the tendency can be favored by selection.
Weighted, not commanded. So helping a sibling is not automatically favored just because there is a sibling-shaped object in the room.
Exactly. Relatedness is probabilistic and relative to the wider population, while benefit, danger, age, recognition, and alternative opportunities all matter.
Give us the uncomfortable domestic version of this logic.
Parents and offspring share many genes, but not all their genetic interests coincide. An offspring can be selected to demand more care than a parent is selected to provide. And siblings can compete over that limited investment.
So family conflict is not evidence that evolution failed to build cooperation. It is part of the design problem.
Yes. Parental care, sibling rivalry, and conflict between potential mates can reflect overlapping but non-identical interests, shaped by the costs and future opportunities each party faces.
And this does not reduce every social animal to a tiny accountant carrying a calculator.
No. The accounting describes which inherited tendencies may spread over generations. It does not say an animal consciously computes relatedness or reproductive return.
The book also brings in game theory, which sounds like evolution putting on a blazer. What does an evolutionarily stable strategy mean?
It means a strategy that cannot readily be displaced once it is common, given the available alternatives and payoffs. Stable does not mean peaceful, admirable, or best for the group.
Take the hawk and dove contrast. Why can restraint win when fighting looks so decisive?
If everyone fights without limit, injury costs can make that population vulnerable to less dangerous strategies. Ritual display, conditional escalation, or conventions about who yields can therefore persist.
But that result depends on what everybody else is doing. Evolution is unknowingly social even before society arrives.
That is the central point of frequency dependence. The success of a tactic depends on its costs and benefits in a population where other tactics already exist.
What about cooperation between non-relatives? Is that just kin selection wearing a fake mustache?
Sometimes both partners gain directly, which is mutualism, and requires no delayed repayment. Reciprocity is harder. Repeated encounters, recognition, consequences for cheating, and a sufficiently open-ended future are needed.
That is where tit-for-tat enters. Begin cooperatively, retaliate after defection, then forgive when cooperation returns.
It is an illuminating example from repeated prisoner's dilemma contests, not a universal recipe. Later analysis makes clear that mixtures of strategies, ecology, information, and population dynamics can change what endures.
And social insects do not let us declare one genetic trick the whole explanation either.
Correct. Kinship can matter greatly, But ecological opportunity and control over reproduction matter too. No simple feature is necessary or sufficient. The broader lesson is conditional cooperation. Help, restraint, conflict, and cheating all depend on transmission routes and circumstances.
We have followed cooperation and conflict inside social life. Now the book makes its most audacious move. Does an organism's evolutionary reach really stop at its skin?
My argument is that it need not. If a gene reliably affects something outside the body, and that effect helps its own transmission, that external effect can count as part of its phenotype.
So not a mystical aura around the animal. Give me an object we can actually point at.
A caddis larva builds a protective case from materials in its surroundings. The case is outside the larva. But genetically influenced building behavior can make it an adaptive effect relevant to survival and reproduction.
That sounds sensible, but also dangerously expandable. Could every useful thing near an animal become an extended phenotype by administrative decree?
No. The point is causal explanation, not relabeling the world. One must show a route from heritable variation through an effect to differential transmission.
The book also looks at one organism tugging on another, yes?
Yes, and those cases are more striking, but often more conjectural. A brood parasite can redirect a foster parent's care toward the parasite's offspring. Where such manipulation aids the parasite's inherited replicators, the relevant effects reach into another animal's behavior.
Which makes the body look less like a unified national border and more like disputed territory.
That is close to the book's point. When genetic elements pass together through a reproductive bottleneck, their interests can become aligned. When they have separate routes of transmission, conflict and exploitation become more likely.
So a harmonious organism is not the starting assumption. It is something evolution may have assembled when the passengers share a vehicle.
Precisely, with an important qualification. Alignment is often substantial, not absolute. Elements such as meiotic drive genes illustrate that what spreads at one genetic level can be costly to the organism.
Then comes the famous cultural detour. Memes, are they genes wearing tiny berets?
They are offered as a tentative analogy, not as a settled science. A tune, idea, or other cultural variant may spread because it is readily copied, even if its spread does not benefit the people carrying it.
And popular is not the same as true, useful, or even remotely good for us.
Exactly. For culture to fit a Darwinian account in a strong sense, questions remain about boundaries, fidelity of copying, variation, and the mechanisms by which information persists and changes.
Here is the hard objection. Once you explain life through selfish replicators, haven't you quietly explained away choice, kindness, and ethics?
No. An evolutionary explanation is not a moral instruction. Selfish is technical shorthand for differential replication. Genes do not intend, calculate, or issue commands. And the book rejects strong genetic determinism.
And it cannot turn every clever story about an animal trait into a discovery.
Quite right. Gene effects are conditional on development. Other genes and environments, while many models and examples identify possible mechanisms rather than proving a particular history.
The later notes matter here because the book does not simply declare itself flawless and walk away in a cape.
They correct some earlier formulations, including claims about evolutionary stability. Whether a strategy persists depends on ecology, population structure, available alternatives, information, and dynamics, not merely on a neat payoff table.
What should a listener notice differently after this? Something more useful than calling everyone a gene machine at dinner?
Ask what is being transmitted, through which route, and under what conditions an observed effect could alter that transmission. Read the book if you want a provocative lens for evolution, especially social behavior. This short conversation leaves out its detailed arguments, animal cases, and the mathematical texture needed to assess them fully.
So the title is doing a lot of mischief. Selfish names a pattern of differential replication, not a tiny villain living in the chromosome.
Exactly. The book asks us to track relatively enduring replicators, usually genes, through the temporary organisms that carry their effects. That is a shift in explanatory viewpoint within neo-Darwinism, not a claim that organisms do not matter.
And it does not make people puppets. Genes affect development in context. They do not issue minute-by-minute orders like a bad office manager.
Quite. Gene effects depend on other genes and environments, and evolutionary explanation does not tell us what humans ought to do.
Then cooperation stopped looking like a free gift from Mother Nature. Helping relatives can spread, but only under particular costs, benefits, relatedness, and opportunities.
Yes, and family life can contain conflict for the same reason. Parents, offspring, and siblings overlap genetically without having identical evolutionary interests.
Outside families, the book adds strategy. Restraint, retaliation, and cooperation can work because they meet a population already playing particular games.
That is the value of evolutionary stability and repeated interaction models. But stable does not mean kind, morally admirable, or even permanently secure when ecology, information, and available strategies change.
The final stretch pushes past the skin. A nest, an engineered environment, or a parasite-driven change in another animal may count if it helps a replicator get copied.
That is the extended phenotype argument. It is powerful as a way of following causal effects. But particular examples can be conjectural and must be judged on evidence.
And memes? A useful provocation, not a cultural master key.
Precisely. Cultural variants may spread because they are transmissible rather than true or beneficial. Yet their boundaries, fidelity, and Darwinian status remain unresolved.
What should a careful reader carry away, especially knowing later notes revise some language and model claims?
Read this if you want a sharp, unsettling lens for asking how traits spread without invoking the good of the species. Keep its corrections and limits in view. It offers a revisable framework for evolutionary questions, not a moral code, a deterministic psychology, or a complete theory of culture.